You need a full marketing team at your side, but you don't need the overhead, contracts, and runaround. Hawk Media can help. Learn more at hawkmedia.com.
You're listening to the Hawk Media Podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping entrepreneurs and executives crush the digital marketing game. Whether you're looking for techniques and strategies or tools and resources, you've come to the right place. Let's get into the show.
Welcome once again to the Hawk Media Podcast, joined today by Drew Neiser, founder and CEO of Renegade. And I am excited that you are here. Thanks for the book. I want to talk about that. I want to get into it. Thanks for being on the show today.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Tony.
Very cool. So let's start with, how did you decide to start this company, and maybe what you did before and where it felt like there was a need for you?
Thanks so much for asking. It's a long story, but I'll make it really short. I've been in marketing for quite a while, have always been looking for different ways other than traditional advertising. And when Dentsu approached me, I was working there at the time, said, hey, we want to start a new group to get some Panasonic business. I said, cool, but they're happy with their agency, which was gray. Can we be the anti-gray? Can we be this non-conforming, non-traditional agency? And that goes back all the way to 1996. And well, in 1996, the internet was just coming. So we built the first website for Panasonic in 1996, built their first blog, did all these things in the digital space. We got them in their first experiential programs. So, you know, we tried to live up to our name as a renegade agency and as a renegade marketer.
That's awesome. I'm a big fan, obviously, of that mentality and of creating value for clients through services in novel ways and not being part of the kind of old guard agency structure. How do you guys differentiate from some of the largers, the Omnicoms and the WPPs of the world?
Well, it's really tricky these days to differentiate because almost everybody says the same thing. I will tell you this. When I bought the agency back essentially from Dentsu in 2008, which October 31st, 2008 was quite a story in and of itself, because as you know, the market pretty much collapsed about a week after I bought the agency, and then 80% of our business walked out the door.
Oh,
so, so other than that, it was a piece of cake.
Sure.
But the challenge of survival really came down to focus. We pivoted to 100% social media. We had been providing it as a service at that point. We made it our focus. That's what saved the agency. But then we realized as social was maturing that the notion of social and isolation was really not so good. In fact, we had two clients who launched national campaigns that we could tell within a day were dead on social. But there was we were sort of stuck with this holding an empty bag on social. So at that point, we said, all right, social is really important to us, and it's going to inspire us. And in fact, we call it social-inspired marketing, but it's not going to be the only thing we do. And we've found a way to use social insights and a social mindset to inform all the marketing that we do. I would say we're a full-service agency as long as you don't consider traditional advertising as part of it. But we're so embedded with social that it's hard to find a renegade program that doesn't really have roots in social thinking and in social strategy.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So when it comes to social, you know, we've had a few different guests recently that are talking about the interplay between social and content and the viral loop and leveraging one for the other and vice versa. I know content is something that's close to your heart. Let's talk a little bit about how to drive effective content marketing strategy and how social ties into that as well.
Yeah, and I do think they're interrelated. In fact, I don't know how you can have a good content program without good social and vice versa. For the purpose of this conversation, I actually made up a quick acronym, and I'll call it PUSH, which is actually the opposite of what you want to do with content. You want to create content that will pull people in. But anyway, let's go with PUSH.
Sure.
All right. So P for purpose. You know, if you're a brand and you have a purpose, it makes it so much easier to have a simplified content strategy because the content just becomes a fulfillment of that purchase purpose. Two is utility. I mean, create content that is of value. At minimum is entertainment value, but often in many brands you can contain something that's useful. Three is story. Lots of people are talking about it, but when I'm talking about story, I mean character, archetypes, voice, and conflict, things that brands don't often consider. They just say, hey, we're going to create a piece of content, and that's it. I think if you think of content as chapters in a story, where you don't necessarily have to tell the whole story in each post. And then the fourth one is humility, and it comes back to that this is sort of the social part of this thing. It's just not about you and your brand, and it's about your stakeholders, your customers, the stories that they want to tell, the stories that investors might tell, and figuring out how you can fuel that. And usually that is not by thinking about yourself. It is having the humility to think about those around you.
Yeah, I think that's a great acronym. Everyone should remember PUSH.
PUSH.
PUSH. But we really want to pull. It's good. It's maybe it'll be sticky because it's the opposite of what we want, right?
Exactly.
Great. Great stuff. So as I'm developing content, as I'm coming up with these things that are of utility and are relevant to my audience, what kind of staff am I looking at? If, I'm a growing business, maybe I'm an online retailer, maybe I'm a SaaS product. What kind of infrastructure investment or capital resources or human capital resources do I need to develop a soup to nuts content strategy? Or should I look outside, or when should I do that?
Well, that's a lot of questions. So
yeah.
let's try to break it down. And one of the things that you see in my book is that, I have 64 elements in the book, and the best marketers are the ones or the chemists that can mix the chemical elements to their greatest advantage. None of them take the same approach with each business, and I think every business has to assess it. There are some businesses where the CEO, small business, is a natural storyteller. They understand that notion, and for them, telling stories is easy, and so they can do a lot of this work in-house. But then there are others who simply say, I'm an engineer, I'm not a storyteller, I don't want to get into that, I need somebody else. So their choice is sort of, do it in-house or outhouse it, if you will. Mm-hmm. Outsource it, hopefully not outhouse it. But by outsourcing it, there's so many different advantages because to me, and this is one that I debate with lots of other folks in the industry, I don't think it's about quantity. I think it's about quality. There's just plenty of crap out there, and there's very little good content. So if I'm starting a business, I want to make sure that every single piece of content I'm proud of, that I share, that's worth somebody's time, because if I really respect their time, they will that will pay back in spades. But if I'm just pushing crap out, I think you fail. So given the fact that you're looking for quality versus quantity, it makes it easier for brands to do it in-house, assuming they have the ability to write and tell a good story.
So when you say push the content out, what do you think are the conduits through which that content is being pushed? And in a social example, because organic reach is coming down,
do you
recommend paid? Do you recommend positioning well for SEO, both? What's your approach there?
Well, sort of, we look at it as building blocks. And so let's say you start with your insight, you know what your purpose is, then you can create this brand narrative on top of it that this is the story that you want to tell, and this is the story that you want told about you. Then you have to layer on your own. That's the first thing, right? Your website, your blog, those things that you create, you've layered on that. Now, people won't just find you unless you're really lucky. So at that point, you have to layer on either you're earned or you're paid. And those two things, depending on the brand today, I mean, I think it's very hard to think about a content program without a paid strategy.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And how are you measuring? You just said, looking at earned versus paid. What kind of tools, what kind of analytics are you using to differentiate between those two buckets and others? Like, what are you
right about? Well, let's go back to the business and let's just figure out, there's four easy things to say that content can do for you. It can build awareness, make it easier when someone's dropped to stop by. They, hey, I've heard of you. It can turn awareness into purchase intent, as in, I saw your website, I want to buy your product. It can encourage repeat business, and it can turn customers into advocates. So those are four things that it can do. Most businesses will say, well, we want to focus on number two, right? Get leads and drive traffic. Mm-hmm. I would say you're better off starting on number three, which is focus on creating content that is of value to your customers. and let them do the advocacy for you, because if you're helping your customers, you're never wasting your time. So if your focus start on number three and you say, I want to create content that will be shared by my advocates, then the key metric is share. Right? I mean, if they share it, then you've succeeded. If they haven't, they haven't. If you're saying, I've got to drive leads, then really, did this content generate organic traffic? Did this content get them from, hey, I read this article on this cool new shoe, to buying the shoe at your store? So, you know, I mean, the hardest metric for any of this is to say, we want this particular piece of content to convert into a sale. And most content studies say that it's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different pieces of content that will eventually result in enough trust to sell it. So it's hard to look at each individual piece and say, it did its job because it generated a lead. So there's a cumulative effect to this thing, which makes it hard to measure. That's a lot of words to say. Yeah. It's not easy, but like a lot of marketing, you sort of have to see the overall result and not put too much emphasis on the individual, the single piece. But are you collectively, with all the pieces working, driving to your goals?
Yeah. I think that, you know, the straight line attribution challenge that gets brought up, especially in the performance marketing world, as it relates to content, is a little bit different, right? Not everything is so cookie cutter. And frankly, even performance marketing channels like pay-per-click aren't simply that one search query that leads to a conversion in most cases. So I think there are a lot of moving pieces, and it's good to know that. But I think you said something important I want to unpack for a second, which is, if we say number three, which is the fact that this content is of value to our customer or prospective customer, client, market, what have you, then the scoreboard should be shares or should be engagement as opposed to lead generation. And that's, I think that's an important distinction.
It is. And in one of the chapters in my book is on Richard Marnell of Viking River Cruises. And, you know, they use content in a really interesting way, or kind of discovered this is how it works. They have a sale and then someone doesn't get on the cruise for 18 months. And so what they found is, if they create this content, these videos, say, of a cooking class in France, and they share it with someone who's going to be on a boat cruise in France, then that person is more likely to be excited about the trip and more likely to share and get someone else to come with them. It's a fascinating use of content that a lot of brands don't think about. And so I always like to call that out, because that's renegade thinking in my mind.
Mm-hmm. And how, you know, one of the talking points that we had on paper before this is how important you think video is to storytelling and content creation in 2016 and beyond, and how can we do that cost effectively?
Well, the first part I've written about extensively, that, you know, I think every brand has to make video a priority, and for several reasons. One, Facebook has said it's a priority, and so any hope of getting organic reach is as a result of native video on Facebook. So number one, that's an issue. Number two, you have a whole generation that's been brought up on video and would rather watch a video than read. So if you want to engage with millennials, you really pretty much have to have video. So then the next question is, how do you do it cost effectively? And that is the million-dollar question. What's interesting, though, is a lot of brands are succeeding with video that is kind of raw, but it feels real and is not a waste of time. So it's not stupid. It can be short, and it can be truthful, and it can be relevant. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a Cannes Film Festival winner for it to have value in the moment.
Yeah, I totally agree with that school of thought that says production value is less important for a lot of companies. And I was speaking with someone recently, I can't remember who, their position was basically, unless you're doing readable video where there's the text overlay and so on, don't even bother, because the engagement rates are so significantly higher on that readable video, because sometimes people are, you know, sitting in class or sitting at their office, and so the sound is off, but having that text overlay on a video has much more engagement. Do you have any data around that? Did you talk to anybody about that?
Yeah, I totally agree. It makes sense to, and we've been doing that too, is you know, add the text, because particularly since it's so often muted when you're looking at a Facebook or even on YouTube. So yeah, adding the text is an easy thing to do. Another thing to be thinking about, there's a company called DotSub, which makes it very easy to do multilingual translations for your videos. A lot of people don't do that, and you know, given a sizable Hispanic population or global audiences for so many different products and services, having multiple language translations in this DotSub makes it pretty easy to do that. So yeah, enhancing video with text makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and you know, we're probably going to go longer than our typical podcast format here, if it's all right with you, just because I definitely want to unpack a few more
terrific
points.
Terrific.
And obviously, we'll circle back to this at the end, I'm sure, but great book, The CMO's Periodic Table, A Renegade's Guide to Marketing, that Drew has written and very generously sent me a free copy of, so appreciate that. And I'm looking forward to thumbing through it. It sounds really nice. Digestible snippets and tons of information in there that is going to be relevant for a lot of the marketers, a lot of the entrepreneurs and business owners listening to this. How do we activate employees as storytellers? You know, this is a bullet point that, again, came up before the show. I think this is really interesting because I literally just interviewed a woman named Marilyn Montoya from Sociable. She's their director of marketing. And it was the first time that I had heard about employee advocacy as a social marketing channel. And they do that as a business. And I thought, man, that's crazy that that hasn't really come up on my radar as like a defined program. And then, of course, as it is in the universe, I've now heard that twice in 3 days. And so I'm curious what your thought is about activating employees as storytellers on behalf of brand.
It's critical, and it's relatively easy, at least when it's with things like Sociable. There's another one, Dynamic Signal, which has a product called VoiceStorm. You can get lots of your employees on it. You can create competitive scenarios. I think the hard part and often the missed part that we see is that companies are getting their employees on it and they are competing, but what they're not doing, because they're not trained to do it, is they're not adding their own personal story on top of it, which is really critical. So you know, it's one thing if you work for a large company and they give you some content to share and you share it on Facebook, and if you don't personalize it, it is so obviously an ad that you've lost what you could have gained. I mean, the whole point of employee activation is employees can reach, you know, a small group of employees can reach 10 million people really quickly and with almost no cost associated with it in a credible way, assuming the employee makes it their own. And that takes training. It really does. And I think that there's going to be a lot more, and this is a business we're developing, is training not only executives on storytelling so that you have this top down, but training employees on how to do it because it makes them more effective in their lives.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if you can turn something into a story, you're far more, just a more interesting person. And that's what we're talking about here is, you know, brands and consumers trying to be, you know, you're either interested or interesting. And those are the two choices in life, mm-hmm. if you want to engage. And I think being interesting is an art form.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm sure for the people that are on staff here at Hawk listening to this podcast at some point, I apologize because the idea of the narrative is something that I say nearly every day in here about, you know, who were we, who are we now, and where are we going? What's exciting? What's going to be exciting, right? This idea of crafting on behalf of our clients, on behalf of ourselves. And I think it is, as you pointed out, it's applicable in business development and client relationships and advertising and in life and being an interesting person. So yeah, it's great. It'll be interesting to see. You said that's a product you're working on now. It's not available yet.
We're developing it with a consulting firm who has developed a very interesting practice, but doesn't want to do all of it. And so we're helping them take what they've done and then turn it into essentially a product.
Cool. Very cool. Let me know when it is. I'm curious.
Yeah.
So listen, I'm sure we could talk for hours and hours. I want to keep this somewhat digestible for everyone. So I'm going to ask you the question that I ask everybody at the end of this podcast, which is, if I am a growing company and I've got a $20,000, a $200,000, or a $2 million quarterly marketing budget, what do you think are the cornerstones of my marketing plan at each of those budget levels?
Wow. Okay. So
big question, I know. Don't get me wrong.
It's a big question, and it is why you and I have companies that clients pay us for, because we think these things through. And so I would say that what I could get to are some fundamentals, but not execution, because it's really strategy is so much more important here. You have to have, in all three cases, you have to know why you're bothering, but why you're in business, and you have to know who, right? Who is it that you want to engage with? And I would argue that most businesses fail on those two elements because they aren't willing to really define the why, and the who is anybody who will buy. And the problem with who, defining who broadly, is that if this game ultimately is about how cost effectively can I acquire customers and then keep them, the cheapest way of acquiring a customer is acquiring a customer that will be happy and will share that information, right? Not just acquiring 100 customers, but acquiring 10 customers that will acquire 100 for you. So you got to get the why, then you get to the who, and now we can get to the what. And depending on the who, there's a lot of different ways to spend your money. One thing that we always start with is, where are you with customer satisfaction? Are your customers at that, 40, 50, 60 net promoter score? If they are not, the first dollars have to be spent there. The next thing we say is, what else could you do from a utility standpoint? We call it marketing as service. What else could you do that would help your customers or prospects live their lives better, one way or another, business or professionally? And again, I think I could do that at any of those budgets. It's just a question of scale. And then at the 2 million level, you start to think about, well, we could probably build a little broader awareness. We could make our who a little bit larger. We could add some more sexy channels. So I think it's really about channels that you're adding and targets that you're adding at the budget levels that you're talking about.
Great. Good answer, because I like the idea of the why and the who to start off with. I think that's oftentimes, as you pointed out, it's overlooked. So Drew, so glad you could join me on the podcast. Thanks again for the book. How do people find out more about you or about Renegade or about the book and get their hands on any or all of those things?
That's awesome. Well, so thank you again for having me. You can find everything about Renegade at renegade.com. You can find my blog at thedrewblog.com. You can find me at Twitter at Drew Neiser. And Renegade is also the proud publisher of Social Media Explorer. So you'll find my content and our team's content and 15 or other fabulous VIP explorers up there as well. So lots of places to engage.
Very awesome. Drew, thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Hawk Media Podcast. To ensure that you never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe to the show in iTunes or your favorite podcast player. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.